I'll have you know the contents of that dumpster are private. You stick your nose in, you'll be violating attorney dumpster confidentiality.
I just wanted to say hello.
Oh. Hello.
All right, we're done.
You think the language in the Second Amendment is clear enough? You know, about the right to bear arms?
Of course it's clear. Every American has the right to hang a pair of bear arms on their wall. How could that possibly be misconstrued?
All right, fantastic then. Wait, you know what? Before we send this to the printer, let's take that abortion thing out.
Oh, come on. I move for a hearing on the matter.
What? You want me to have a special motion on the admissibility of the word asshole?
Well, let me have ass then. That's close enough.
What law school did you go to?
I'll agree to it, Your Honor.
You will? Why?
I don't want any interlocutory appeals.
What are you, a comedy team?
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that breaks down the law behind all the news stories you care about. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hey guys, I'm Liz Dye. With me is Andrew Torres, and this is Opening Arguments, episode 724.
Hey Liz, how you doing today?
I'm all right. How are you?
I am fantastic, and fantastic for doing the show with you, but also fantastic for all sorts of crazy stuff dropped today, and somehow we managed to get through it, and I'm excited to do the show.
Yeah, Pacer Alert's going crazy. And we had to add a new one because Donald Trump is suing Michael Cohen for $50 million.
This is just bonkers in every conceivable way, and I love it. We will break it down on the show tomorrow. It looked like it, I mean, it's not going anywhere, so we didn't have to, you know, scramble the whiteboard today. I thought about tweeting out, like, you know, a picture of like one of the big bowls with like 50 eggs in it, and a, you know, animated gif of someone, you know, whisking those eggs, but to describe our whiteboard, but no, like, yeah, this, it is an unbelievable gift for Alvin Bragg. I will say that.
Yeah. I will check at the break to see if it has gotten assigned to a judge. It had not been as of when we started recording, but let's pick it up tomorrow. It will be delightful, and we're going to need something delightful because tomorrow, because tonight is pretty clear that the Fifth Circuit is going to rule on that Mifepristone abortion case that from our, you know, evil villain Judge Kaczmarek from Texas. So, you know, that's going to be horrible, and we're going to need a little levity to counterbalance it tomorrow.
Indeed. Let me give just a brief procedural overview. That case before the Fifth Circuit is Alliance, right? That's the bad case from Kaczmarek, because the AstroTurf group has the Orwellian name of Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine because, you know, do no harm by, you know, making... Anyway, I won't get down the rabbit trail. I'm mad. That briefing has been concluded on Danko. That's the manufacturer's motion to stay. There is still no panel assigned as of this recording, which is weird. Mm-hmm. So we're going to break down on tomorrow's show what happened and the briefing. I will tell you, regardless of your view on abortion, and let's be honest, if you're not pro-choice, you're wrong. But even if you aren't, like, any objective reader, anyone who knows anything about the law would look at the Danko and FDA briefs and then the bizarre arguments on behalf of Alliance and conclude that the arguments on behalf of Danko and the FDA are very, very strong. In particular, Danko's brief is great. Mm-hmm. It's really, really good.
Yeah. Let's read a little bit from it here. Here's a bit from Danko's brief where they talk about all of the things which Alliance would have to prove in order for this, you know, crazy ruling to stand. It says, for Danko to be likely to succeed on appeal, it must be right on just one of the following. Number one, standing. Number two, limitations. Number three, exhaustion. Number four, the FDA's obligations under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Number five, the impropriety of a non-expert judge second-guessing or ignoring FDA's detailed scientific analysis and reweighing its risk and benefit analysis. Number six, the impropriety of ignoring FDA's reasoning. Or number seven, the impropriety of using a mandatory injunction to negate a long-standing drug approval, all before even reviewing the administrative record. So we're probably going to get a ruling from the Fifth Circuit tonight. right after this record, and we'll get back to that one tomorrow. We're gonna give you mostly a break on this horrible decision today.
Yep.
You want the rest of the champagne?
No, and it's pronounced champagne.
Oh, God, no!
It's not a big deal.
I get so lonely.
Okay, we gotta start off with a quick Andrew was wrong.
I'm going for Judge Jana Protas.
Janet
Prozaski?
Protasaves?
Judge Janet Protasaves.
Janet Protasiewicz for Supreme Court.
Protasiewicz, Protasiewicz, Protasiewicz.
I'm Judge Janet Protasiewicz.
Protasiewicz.
Well, Liz, I wish I'd had that clip when we talked about Janet Protasiewicz and her victory a couple of days ago. We got, you know, conservatively speaking, 84,000 emails from the entire state of Wisconsin saying, hey, you know, if you're gonna love on our new Supreme Court justice, then maybe say her name right. And I'll wear the L on that one.
I mean, it does seem fair.
All right. So we heard... Moving on.
Spider-Man wasn't attacking the city. He was trying to save it. That's slander.
It is not. I resent that. Slander is spoken. In print, it's libel.
Okay, so next week, Dominion Voting Systems defamation case against Fox gets going in earnest, for trial. We've talked about this case in episode 705 and then again in episode 718 when the court partially granted Dominion's motion for summary judgment.
Yep. And if you haven't heard those and you care about this case, definitely go back and listen. So remember that Dominion alleged 20 defamatory statements and the court said, yes, all of those are indeed defamatory. I cannot overstate the magnitude of this ruling. So the only issues left for trial, which, as Liz points out, starts on Monday. Jury selection is supposed to be Thursday. So Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday will be, motions and lemonade and the like. The only issues left are one, the extent of Dominion's damages, two, whether Fox acted with actual malice, and that will be the bulk of the factual dispute at mm-hmm. trial, right? And then three, whether Fox Corporation, right, the parent company of Fox News, is going to be held liable, or if the buck stops with the Fox News network.
Yeah, and Fox, getting a jump on things, has already started to get its ass kicked thanks to its own egregiously stupid conduct. Apparently, they have gone to some lengths to obfuscate the fact that Rupert Murdoch is not just the CEO of Fox Corporation, but also is an officer at Fox News, which will likely be relevant to that issue of liability of the parent company. So that emerged on Tuesday, at which point Delaware Superior Court Judge Eric Davis told Fox's lawyers, you have a credibility problem. And he said, I need to feel comfortable that when you represent something to me, that it's the truth. And that was not true.
Wow. I mean, again, I just want to put this in for if a sitting trial court judge looked at me in open court and said, I don't feel comfortable that what you're telling to me, that what you are representing in open court is the truth, I would cry. my client would absolutely fire me, right? Like, it just, I cannot stress how rare it is for a court to say that sort of thing.
Yeah, not great. So Fox's lawyers responded. They defended Murdoch and they said, well, he only has a ceremonial role at Fox News. And okay.
I can't wait for that cross-examination of Rupert Murdoch.
Oh, my God.
Your lawyers said that you just have a ceremonial role at Fox News.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Is that true?
Yeah. Right. Then the lawyers got super huffy with reporters, and they put out a statement saying that, quote, Rupert Murdoch has been listed as executive chairman of Fox News in our SEC filing since 2019, and this filing was referenced by Dominion's own attorney during his deposition. I don't think that's actually... I don't think that's how discovery works.
No, it very much is not how discovery works. When you are required to disclose, look, like, you can answer a deposition question by reference to a document, right? Like, so if you get an interrogatory, you can say, you know, we refer you to our SEC filings. The problem is they did not exclusively do that. And you can't just say, like, people kind of know X, Y, and Z, when the point of discovery is to pin you down on that party's legal admissions in the case.
Yeah. Well, actually, things managed to get worse because it emerged that Fox has been hiding a whole bunch of stuff, including tapes of Rudy Giuliani saying things to Maria Bartiromo like, I can't prove that yet in regard to some of the allegations he was making about Dominion on air. Yeah. Yeah. Dominion's lawyers played a recording of that exchange in court today after it came to light in the discrimination suit brought by Maria Bartiromo's former producer, Abby Grossberg. We talked to you about that case in episode 715.
Yeah. Also, Abby Grossberg predicting that she would be Dominion's star witness. And here we go. that's looking pretty amazing, Kreskin-like already. So look, this is the kind of thing that will get you in deep, hot water with the court, right? And apparently, Judge Davis was having none of this, right? As the New York Times reports, Judge Davis said from the bench, there's no written order, that he is likely to appoint a special master to investigate Fox's discovery failures. That's bad. And he told them to maintain all of their internal attorney communications on the issue of Murdoch's role at Fox News. That's real bad. Uh-huh. And then he told them to let Dominion depose any additional witnesses immediately at Fox's expense. And I think Dominion kind of gave a no comment to that because, right, like, they're supposed to go to trial in 2 days, you know, 2 business days. Like, I don't know if you would want to depose someone and then, you know, have to push back your trial. Like, this is really going to be a strategic question for Dominion's lawyers. And again, it's, you know, sort of an abundant, right? Like, you're standing before the dragon's horde and it's like, I can't choose which of these shiny baubles I want to take. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I feel like for Fox's lawyers, it's maybe like the opposite. It's like, you know, do you want to die by drowning or fire? Like, neither of these is good. This is a very inauspicious beginning.
Yeah. For the bad guys. So, you know, yeah. So that's why we're laughing and giggling, and you should be too. So then it gets better. Judge Davis told Fox in no uncertain terms not to try to claim as a defense before the jury that the defamatory statements were newsworthy. He promised that he was going to shut that down immediately and ditto for any attempt to introduce broadcasts. This is my favorite, where the network didn't defame the plaintiff, right? It's like that clip from the Alex Jones trial that we play all the time, right? Is the defendant's position that its non-defamatory statements balance out its defamatory ones?
Yeah, no, that's not going to work. And to top it all off, cherry on top of this whole shit Sunday, Rupert and Lachlan Murdoch and several members of the Fox board just got themselves a shareholder lawsuit alleging that they breached fiduciary duty by airing all this defamatory nonsense about Dominion. So, you know, womp womp.
An exceptional use of womp womp. And now, on to our main story.
I thought you said the law was powerless.
You're powerless to help you, not punish you. Earned my treat.
Okay, Andrew, so do you feel like a little more Andrew was wrong about Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg, or are you still team chicken shit?
It's tough. So if I want to make a counter-argument to my own public and long-standing position on team chicken shit, it would be this. It would be that Bragg was so persuaded that Alan Weisselberg was never going to flip, always going to obstruct everything he did, that, you know, he sort of tried to cut his losses. I don't know. Like, it still seems to me, I cannot come up with a good reason for his failure to just go to trial against Weisselberg. But that being said, I can't say he's on team chicken shit with respect to Donald Trump.
No, he is not. Nor Jim Jordan. Yeah, that guy has definitely gone up several notches in my book since he gave Trump Org CEO Weisselberg that sweetheart deal in exchange for, you know, big nothing.
Right.
First, okay, yes, he actually delivered us that 34-count indictment of Trump. not complaining. And also because he has, in fact, come out swinging in the face of Republican attacks this past week.
Yeah. So you mentioned, but did you, Liz, have on your bingo card the Manhattan District Attorney's Office suing House Judiciary Chair Jim Jordan? Because I, for one, did not.
Girl, same. I mean, I guess we should have, you know, maybe anticipated it when Jordan and his dingus pal, James Comer at Oversight and Brian Steele at the House Administration Committee started dropping subpoenas on prosecutors. Okay, to be fair, they've only dropped one, but they are promising that there are more to come.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Pin in that. It will come up. So to review where we are, we discussed the ways that House Republicans are trying to intimidate Alvin Bragg in episode 716. And also, we amplified on that in the Patreon bonus to episode 718. Essentially, what they've been doing is plastering his office with stupid letters, demanding that he turn over every piece of paper with Trump's name on it, and then come testify about his ongoing investigation on live television. And like, there is just no universe where local prosecutions fall under congressional purview.
Yeah, that's not even a close question.
No, it is not, right? Article 1, which you may recognize as the beginning of the Constitution, right, describes Congress's powers and obligations, and nowhere does it say that the House and the Senate are entitled to oversee the executive branch, although, you know, we've come to accept that as part of their role, right, and for investigative reasons. We discussed that at length in 716. But the 10th Amendment specifically says that, quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And so in plain English, what that means is there is nothing in there about the federal government being able to police local law enforcement. That's left to the states. And so Congress does not get to do it. Well, okay. There are exceptions for things like civil rights investigations where they're enforcing federal law or constitutional rights, but that's its own separate thing, right? Like that's not just oversight right. of state prosecutions, right? So the reality is there is an uninterrupted, unambiguous 2.5 centuries of case law saying that all three branches of the federal government need to keep their noses out of local prosecutions. And again, most of that case law is deeply, deeply conservative. Mm-hmm. So let me read briefly, for example, from John Roberts' opinion in NFIB versus Sebelius, right? Which, okay, you know, if the our non-listening, you know, Trump wing of the party thinks Roberts is a squishy liberal, but look, like that 2014 decision was the predicate for, yes, it narrowly kept Obamacare intact, but it was the Supreme Court finding that regulating health care was not part of Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, which for 2014 was, you know, about as radical a restriction on the power of Congress that you could possibly imagine, right? Yeah, healthcare isn't interstate commerce. That's bizarre. Mm-hmm. Anyway, here's what Roberts said in NFIB versus Sebelius. The Constitution is not the source of the state's power. The Constitution may restrict state governments, as it does, for example, by forbidding them to deny any person the equal protection of the laws. But where such prohibitions do not apply, state governments do not need constitutional authorization to act. Thus, the states can and do perform many of the vital functions of modern government, punishing street crime, running public schools, and zoning property for development, just to name a few, even though the Constitution's text does not authorize any government to do so. Our cases refer to this general power of governing possessed by the states, but not by the federal government, as the police power. And we'll delve more into the police power after this ad break. This is an ad for Green Chef. Now, I know what you're thinking. Andrew, don't you do ads for HelloFresh? Well, turns out Green Chef is owned by HelloFresh. So, with a wider array of meal plans to choose from, there's something for everyone. OA listeners can enjoy both brands at a discount. And Green Chef has so many options. Keto, protein-packed, vegan, vegetarian, fast and fit, Mediterranean, gluten-free. They are the only keto meal kit. So, you know, if you're counting carbs, like in my family, Green Chef makes sticking to that lifestyle easy. You know I love to cook. You also know how overworked I am, and I love the convenience of Green Chef. You can choose from among more than 30 recipes every week and even mix and match dietary preferences in the same box without changing your plan. So, you know, order vegan meals one day, keto the next, Green Chef doesn't care. And now, here's the deal. What do you think of 60% off and free shipping? Sound too good to be true? Head on over to greenchef.com/OA60 and use code OA60 to get 60% off plus free shipping. That's right. Go to greenchef.com/OA60. Use promo code OA60 to get 60% off plus free shipping. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well. And we're back.
Okay, so to be clear, the police power means a state, like, say, New York, has the power to punish individuals and businesses within its jurisdiction that file, you know, fraudulent business records, right. As an example.
Yeah, good, you know, hypo here. So here's Chief Justice John Roberts again waxing philosophical about how any interference with that police power is creeping totalitarianism. Again. State sovereignty is not just an end in itself. Rather, federalism secures to citizens the liberties that derive from the diffusion of sovereign power. Because the police power is controlled by 50 different states instead of one national sovereign, the facets of governing that touch on citizens' daily lives are normally administered by smaller governments closer to the governed. The framers thus ensured that powers in which the ordinary course of affairs concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people were held by governments more local and more accountable than a distant federal bureaucracy. And that's a citation to Federalist number 45.
Oh, so you're saying that Alvin Bragg, the elected district attorney in Manhattan, is accountable to the citizens of New York who elected him and not, say, oh, I don't know, a congressman from Ohio?
Well, you know, I am, but that's because I'm not a fascist enthralled to a criminally insane game show host as my god king. But yeah, before we leave again, this is mainstream conservative legal thought. One last bit from John Roberts. The independent power of the states also serves as a check on the power of the federal government. By denying any one government complete jurisdiction over all the concerns of public life, federalism protects the liberty of the individual from arbitrary power. So, perhaps the most significant way in which federalism is implemented is through a doctrine called Younger abstention. And just put a pin in that one for now. Yeah. I promise you we'll get to it. Bottom line here from NFIB versus Sebelius is that states get to prosecute crimes and the federal government shouldn't interfere with that. And by ensuring that the federal government lacks jurisdiction over state prosecutions, we're all more free, case closed.
And yet, Jim Jordan and his band of goons came up with a bunch of nonsensical explanations as for why Congress does too get to tell local prosecutors what to do. First, they said they needed to enact statutes to ensure that the Secret Service and local prosecutors don't shoot each other if and when a, you know, former president gets arrested. Then they said that maybe they needed to pass a law allowing ex-presidents to transfer criminal charges against them into federal court after they leave office, which is bonkers. I can't even. And then Jordan got super excited because he found out, because Alvin Bragg disclosed it, that the Manhattan DA used $5,000 of federal funds to investigate the Trump Organization way back when Cyrus Vance Jr. was running it in 2021. And then Jim Jordan figured this was an awesome lever to get all the way up the ass end of every detail of this investigation, which is not how any of this goes.
No, it is not. In fact, if this were how stuff goes, then the Justice Department would be able to dictate how, you know, every police department in the country does anything because they all receive some kind of federal money. And, you know, $5,000, right? Again, not going to turn it down if you want to sign up as a $5,000 patron. But like in the scope of an investigation is not a lot of money. And,
right.
And frankly speaking, like, we could have a national environmental policy because every state receives federal funds for environmental cleanup, which, you know, would be fine by us, but presumably not by Jim Jordan. So anyway, under his wildly expansive definition of legislative interest, federalism, right, that stuff that I just choked back John Roberts waxing philosophical about for 10 minutes would be meaningless.
Right. And speaking of that's not how this goes. It is not traditional for prosecutors to quit their jobs and then write a tell-all book about their work on behalf of the government. And yet, that's exactly what prominent white-collar lawyer Mark Pomerantz did after a year working as a special assistant DA in Bragg's office on that criminal investigation of Trump. But this was the earlier version, not the Stormy right. Daniels part. This was the one that was about the fraudulent financial dockets. Bragg then declined to prosecute those charges, although eventually New York Attorney General Letitia James did bring civil suit. We've talked about that on the show.
Right.
But in February of 2022, Pomerantz and another attorney named Carrie Dunn, who joined the office to prosecute Trump, both resigned. And they did it loudly.
Yeah.
And in a scathing letter that somehow became public, Pomerantz accused Bragg of dropping the ball by refusing to prosecute on those business charges. And then Pomerantz wrote a book about how guilty Trump was and refused to clear it pre-publication with the DA's office. He called it People versus Donald Trump.
You did not that subtle, right?
No.
And so, look, I suppose in one sense, I should fess up here, right? That when Pomerantz published that letter, we discussed that on Opening Arguments, and I sided with Pomerantz on the side of, yeah, gosh, like it does seem to be, you know, rather chicken shit to not follow through on.
Yeah, I wrote about it at Above the Law. I mean, I said that it was just as bad as, you know, look, because it was pretty clear what happened. And I wrote about mm-hmm. it in an article that said, you know, this was as bad as we all suspected it was.
Yeah. But I suspect that had either of us been asked to opine on a fact not then in evidence, which was that Pomerantz's book was not cleared
yeah.
for pre-publication with the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, we would have come down on the side of the Manhattan DA's office. I know that because I talked about that exact same process with, you know, mustache enthusiast and former UN representative John Bolton. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I stuck up for that guy, like, I'm pretty sure I would have stuck up for Bragg. Like, that's that's a condition of your job, that if you have learned stuff while serving in that sort of governmental capacity, that you've got to get it cleared before you go public with it.
And so, look, we talk a lot about why Mueller said he couldn't kind of divulge the internal workings of his investigation. Lots of prosecutors say, or as Bragg has said here, I can't give you the internal grand jury workings because it violates the due process of people if they aren't charged. And
right.
that's not just lip service. I think that that's true. I think that it was not only inappropriate for Pomerantz to write this book, but it did in some sense violate due process because he's got this book about how guilty Trump is, and Trump wasn't charged. That's just not how it's supposed to go, as we've said a bunch of times in this show.
Yeah, and it's not helpful in
nope.
the sense that it has given Jim Jordan a non-stupid argument. And, like, let's just let him, you know, have enough rope to hang himself without helping him, okay? So here's how that worked. Because on April 6th, after the Manhattan District Attorney's Office said that it was going to block Pomerantz's testimony, Jim Jordan issued a subpoena for Pomerantz and pointed to Pomerantz's book as having waived attorney-client and work product privilege because, you know, he spilled all the details on the internal workings of the Trump investigation. And that's not an inherently crazy argument.
Yeah. I mean, that part's not correct. The rest of Jim Jordan's letter to Pomerantz is a hot mess. It's all bullshit. He screams that Pomerantz was, quote, searching for any basis on which to bring criminal charges, but he wouldn't acknowledge that Bragg refused to bring those charges because he saw it as a weak case. Instead, right. Jordan fudges, and he says that Pomerantz, quote, resigned because the investigation into President Trump was not proceeding fast enough for your liking. That's not what happened. And then Jordan goes on to accuse Pomerantz of using his book to put, quote, political pressure on District Attorney Bragg to charge Trump with crimes. Meanwhile, Jordan and James Comer, who, I mean, that guy needs flashcards to be stupid. He's really, anyway, Comer has been all over TV threatening to drop more subpoenas and promising that they're going to put Bragg and everyone from the Manhattan District Attorney's Office under oath. Here's Comer beating his chest with our buddy Maria Bartiromo.
Mr. Chairman, it's good to have you back. Thanks very much for being here. Bragg is firing back at you. What are you going to do? Are you willing to subpoena him to come talk to you under oath?
Well, this is of the utmost importance to the American people. I think most people in America are sick and tired of the government getting involved in our election process. We want free and fair elections. I don't think anyone believes that Donald Trump would be in Manhattan District Court right now were he not a candidate for president of the United States. So we have a lot of questions for the Manhattan District Attorney. He doesn't have the luxury, whether or not to determine whether he can show up for congressional inquiry. I think we're going to use whatever means necessary because we're concerned about, again, election interference. We're also concerned about wasteful spending. We have a crime crisis in America. One of the reasons we have a crime crisis is because we have soft on crime district attorneys. And you look at the crime rate in New York, we feel like the DA's time would be better spent trying to prosecute criminals.
Yeah, there is just no universe where James Comer's feelings about how Bragg should spend his time or, you know, literally anything else are relevant to a congressional inquiry.
Right. Although Jim Jordan announced Monday that he'll be holding a, quote, field hearing next week with, quote, victims of Bragg's supposedly pro-crime, anti-victim policies. Yeah, so Bragg fired back by noting that crime has actually gone down in his district since he took office. You know. And BT Dubs, New York is one of the safest big cities in America. He then invited Jordan to check out crime in, say, Columbus or Akron or Toledo or Cincinnati or Cleveland or Dayton if he has, you know, real concerns about rising violent crime. And that was satisfying. I apologize to my cousins in Ohio. But not as satisfying as filing a federal lawsuit against Jordan, which, as you said, he did yesterday.
Oh, so this case was filed in the Southern District of New York, and it names both Pomerantz and Jordan as chair of the House Judiciary Committee. Now, normally, you can't sue a member of Congress. That's barred under the Speech and Debate Clause. But you can sue to block a subpoena. So by including Pomerantz, he's got the subpoena, which is an issue that the court might actually adjudicate.
Yeah, and let's be fair. I suspect there's no love lost between Bragg and Pomerantz. You know, see above.
I think that's a safe bet, right? So Bragg wanted a temporary restraining order, a TRO, and or a preliminary injunction to block the subpoena and any future subpoenas, which he calls, quote, an unprecedentedly brazen and unconstitutional attack by members of Congress on an ongoing New York State criminal prosecution and investigation of former President Donald J. Trump, end of quote. And he's right. And he's, look, making all of the arguments that we talked about on Tuesday. He's talking about federalism. And here's where we pull that pin on younger abstention, because I think we need to do a mini deep dive.
Wouldn't you? No, I'm teasing.
No. It's true. But like, I think you want to understand sort of just how ad hoc this is. Mm-hmm. So younger abstention is named after a 1971 Supreme Court case called Younger versus Harris. And let's understand a little bit of context. Point one, it's 1971. That is almost certainly the liberal heyday of the Supreme Court. And that, dear listeners, is what we call foreshadowing. Point two, and I got a couple here, is that abstention is the larger doctrine in which federal courts decline to hear a case. Typically, sometimes it's in favor of administrative proceedings, but typically abstention comes up because you have a state case and a federal case, and the federal court abstains, allows the state to go forward. Mm-hmm. And notice, the abstention doctrine turns the typical operation and justification of federal courts on their heads, right? Like we've talked about on the show, for example, that diversity jurisdiction is based on the principle from the 18th century that federal courts are likely more fair and less parochial than state courts, right? We didn't want people getting homered in state courts, so we allow them to get into federal court on state claims under certain circumstances. And federal question jurisdiction is based on the idea that, you know, you'd rather have federal courts adjudicating what federal law and the U.S. Constitution means than having state courts do so. So you see an ordinary justification and application of preferring federal courts. That, for example, is why you can actually appeal some state Supreme Court opinions to the U.S. Supreme Court if the state decides to opine on, you know, what the 14th Amendment means or something.
Right.
And point three here is that Younger v. Harris ostensibly was about the California Criminal Syndicalism Act, which was sections 114.00 and 114.01 of the California Penal Code. That's a 1919 anti-communist law that criminalized, I wish we were kidding, but, you know, history is history. It criminalized any person who advocates, teaches by spoken or written words, justifies or attempts to justify, prints, publishes, edits, issues, circulates, or publicly displays any book or document advocating or teaching what it calls criminal syndicalism, defined as, quote, any doctrine or precept advocating, teaching, or aiding and abetting the commission of willful and malicious physical damage or injury to physical property as a means of accomplishing a change in industrial ownership or control or affecting any political change. So the act said it's illegal to be a communist or a socialist.
Right.
For good measure, the act also criminalized, quote, knowingly becoming a member of any group that advocated or taught criminal syndicalism, as well as committing any act, quote, with intent to accomplish a change in industrial ownership or control or affecting any political change. So that means if you went to Berkeley and joined the local Students for a Democratic Society on campus, you were in violation of the law. And by the way, that made you guilty of a felony. And the punishment for violating the criminal syndicalism law was a minimum of a year in prison to a maximum of 14 years.
Yeah. And so I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, surely the Supreme Court weighed in and said this law plainly violates the First Amendment because, you know, it makes it illegal for you to be a member of a socialist organization. And you'd be half right because the Supreme Court did weigh in on the law in a 1927 case called Whitney versus California, only it did so to affirm that the law was, you know, plenty constitutional at the time.
Ew.
Yeah, because look, the Supreme Court's been a lot of hot garbage for a lot of our nation's history.
Yeah.
So here's what the court said in 1927. And by the way, this is in the context of all of these. We did this way, way back in, I think, the first season of Opening Arguments. But if you ever hear anybody use the, you know, Schenck v. U.S., fire in a crowded movie theater aphorism, that was not about a fire in a movie theater. That was about the dangers of creeping communism.
Uh-huh.
So, 1927, Supreme Court, Whitney versus California said, nor is the syndicalism, after approving it on a whole bunch, right, like it's also unconstitutionally vague, like this law is a stupid, bad, awful law that the Supreme Court should have struck down immediately. It went out of its way to preserve it, and it said the Syndicalism Act, as applied in this case, is not repugnant to the Due Process Clause as a restraint of the rights of free speech, assembly, and association. That the freedom of speech, which is secured by the Constitution, does not confer an absolute right to speak, that's true, without responsibility, whatever one may choose, or an unrestricted and unbridled license giving immunity for every possible use of language and preventing the punishment of those who abuse this freedom. Okay. And that a state may, by the exercise of its police power, may punish those who abuse this freedom by utterances inimical to the public welfare, tending to incite to crime, disturb the public peace, or endanger the foundations of organized government and threaten its overthrow by unlawful means, is not open to question.
Good gravy.
Yeah. Okay. So let's put all that together. It's now 50 years later, right? We're going back to Younger v. Harris, right? We finally got a Supreme Court that says if the First Amendment means anything, it means, you know, we can't arrest people for registering as a socialist or teaching about Karl Marx in the classroom. Again, both of which were felonies under this California law, right? And here's where we enter John Harris, who was a member of the Progressive Labor Party, a socialist party, who was charged and prosecuted under the Criminal Syndicalism Act for being a socialist. Harris then filed a complaint in federal district court after he was arrested. He asked it, the federal court, to enter an injunction prohibiting Younger, who was the district attorney of Los Angeles County, from prosecuting him under this patently, obviously unconstitutional law. And not going to deep dive within a deep dive about 28 U.S.C. Section 2284. Just take our word for it that that allowed the district court to convene a special three-judge panel. They overturned, right? They held that California's Criminal Syndicalism Act was void for vagueness and overbreadth in violation of the First and 14th Amendments and restrained the district attorney from any, quote, further prosecution of the currently pending action against Plaintiff Harris for alleged violation of the act. So there you go. Case closed. System works. We can all go. No,
yay.
Of course not.
No.
No. The prosecutor, Younger, appealed to the Supreme Court. And via an 8-1 decision, the most liberal Supreme Court in our nation's history reversed, holding that the federal courts, see if you see where we're going with this, could not intervene while a state criminal prosecution was pending.
And we will get to the punchline after this brief ad break.
This is an ad for Shady Rays, the sunglass sponsor that shares our values over here at OA. So Shady Rays makes high-quality sunglasses that are available at a fraction of the price of, you know, the expensive brands I'm talking about. So if you're like me and, you know, occasionally you've left your sunglasses on the roof of your car before driving away, or, you know, heard that unsatisfying crunch when you sit down in your seat, right? You will never worry about that again, because every pair of Shady Rays is backed by their industry-leading Lost and Broken Replacements program. So you take them out of the box and break them the second you get, they will send you a replacement pair for free. If you order a pair and you don't like them for any reason, you have 30 days to exchange or return them for a full refund. That's customer service. And as I suggested at the beginning of the ad, with every order, the Shady Rays Impact Program works with nonprofits to benefit children and young adults, like building playgrounds for pediatric cancer patients. So what's better than getting one pair of Shady Rays and not worrying if you break or lose them? Why? Getting two. So head on over to shadyrays.com/opening. Use our code opening. And for a limited time, when you buy one pair of Shady Rays, you'll get a second pair free. That's shadyrays.com/opening. Code opening to get a second pair of Shady Rays free. shadyrays.com/opening. Code opening.
Hey guys, this is an ad for RexMD, the most trusted leader in men's telehealth. And by men's telehealth, I mean erectile dysfunction, sexual health, hair growth, you know, the stuff that guys are sometimes nervous about for no reason. Erectile dysfunction is a common medical issue that over 30 million men in the U.S. tackle every day. The doctors at RexMD will evaluate you online, no office visit needed, and ship medication directly to your door before the big day. With RexMD, they're here to help and provide you with real FDA-approved medications at the best price. RexMD makes getting generic and branded Viagra or Cialis easy. Everything's online, even the prescription, and they deliver discreetly to your door. No waiting rooms, no trips to the doctor, no insurance, and no copays. Take advantage of their best deal ever and save up to 90% off and pay as low as $2 per pill with our exclusive link. Go to rexmd.com/OA for this limited time deal. RexMD has made the whole process so simple. There's no need to jump through a bunch of hoops. With just a few clicks of a button, you can talk to a medical professional and create a personalized plan and get the products discreetly shipped straight to your door within 2 days. It's fast, simple, and cheap, and you can access your U.S. licensed RexMD physician anytime you need afterwards. RexMD has already helped over 350,000 guys gain confidence quickly and conveniently, and they're here to help you. Act now to take advantage of their deal by heading to rexmd.com/OA. Our exclusive deal will save up to 90% off, where you'll pay as low as $2 per dose on generic Viagra instead of $90 plus on branded Viagra. Starter packs of generic Viagra or Cialis are now available for our listeners to get started. That's rexmd.com/OA for up to 90% off. Your partner will thank you.
And we are back. So here's the justification the Supreme Court offered in sending poor Harris back to California to get prosecuted for the heinous crime of being a socialist. The court said, since the beginning of this country's history, Congress has manifested a desire to permit state courts to try state cases free from interference by federal courts. The precise reason for this longstanding public policy against federal court interference with state court proceedings is a proper respect for state functions, a recognition of the fact that the entire country is made up of a union of separate state governments, and a continuation of the belief that the national government will fare best if the states and their institutions are left free to perform their separate functions in their separate ways. This, referred to by many as our federalism, represents a system in which there is sensitivity to the legitimate interests of both state and national governments, and in which the national government, anxious though it may be to vindicate and protect federal rights and federal interests, always endeavors to do so in ways that will not unduly interfere with the legitimate activities of the states.
Yep, that's pretty clear. And then, just cherry on top, the most liberal member of the court in possibly in Supreme Court history, right? My personal hero, William Brennan, penned a concurrence, right? He was part of the eight, agreeing with sending Harris back to a California court to prosecute him under a blatantly unconstitutional law. And here's what he said justifying that. He said, Harris had been indicted for violations of the California Criminal Syndicalism Act, before he sued in federal court. He has not alleged that the prosecution was brought in bad faith to harass him. His constitutional contentions may be adequately adjudicated in the state criminal proceeding, and federal intervention at his instance was therefore improper. So, that ends our deep dive. But I thought it was critical to kind of go through that entire history so that, you know, our listeners understand just how entrenched this principle is. The federal government does not mess with state prosecutions, right? If the courts wouldn't do it for Younger, they damn well shouldn't do it for Jim Jordan.
Right. And if that's not enough, consider that Trump himself spent years suing to block congressional subpoenas for his financial documents. He also sued to block this very investigation when Vance was the Manhattan DA on the theory that presidents were immune from state, civil, and criminal process.
Yeah, the theory on which there was Supreme Court law directly on the opposite point. But anyway, I digress. The important part there is Trump lost. Mm-hmm. And along the way, he forced the Supreme Court to adjudicate both the civil subpoenas and also the congressional subpoenas. And that's how we ended up with both Trump v. Vance and Trump v. Mazars.
Right. Just to refresh our listeners' memory, Mazars was Trump's accounting firm. And when Democrats took back the House in 2019, they subpoenaed Trump's tax records and all of his financial records from Mazars, and Trump sued to block it. At the same time that Cyrus Vance, the former Manhattan district attorney, was kind of closing in on the same information, and Trump sued to block that too. The court came down with the conclusion, and it's kind of a bugbear of mine, but the court came down with a four-factor test in the Mazars opinion, and it was to assess congressional subpoenas of a sitting president. So the four factors are whether the legislative subpoena and the investigation warrants the involvement of the president, or if other sources can reasonably provide Congress with the same bit of information. That's the first factor. The second factor is whether the subpoena is no broader than reasonably necessary to support this legislative objective. Okay. The third factor is whether the nature of evidence that is required by the subpoena will advance a valid legislative purpose. And kind of keep valid legislative purpose in your mind, because that's really the most important part here. And then the fourth is whether the subpoena burdens the president and may be a result of partisan politics. Okay.
Yeah.
Those things really clearly would pertain to a sitting executive. And when I read the opinion, I said, okay, this seems reasonable. And then I spent all of, you know, the past year reading all of these briefs from people trying to defeat January 6th committee subpoenas. And every single one of them, and let's be clear, those were all Republicans, every single one of them referenced the Mazars standard and treated it as if it is the standard by which to assess any legislative subpoena,
right?
So now they have said this is a general principle. It doesn't have to do with the executive branch. This is how you decide whether an executive, whether a congressional subpoena has a legitimate legislative purpose and should be honored. You know, although Jim Jordan, let's be clear, ignored the subpoena from the January 6th committee, despite multiple courts saying this was a legitimate legislative purpose.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not a rule for Republicans. But no, I think this is a really, really good point to make. It is not one that I have seen raised elsewhere, right, among legal commentators, certainly not in kind of general news circles. So I'm glad you're illustrating it here. I want to point out as evidence for that, when you look at the documents with us, you will see that quotations from Mazars have to quote around all that language about, like, whether the legislative request warrants the involvement of the president, right? Like, and they'll have to say, warrants the involvement of, and then drop quotes, and then insert, like, you know, whoever they are here, you know, here, the district attorney's office, right? It is just an illustration of the way in which it is being subtly appropriated for cases where different equities ought to be involved, right? Like, there are different concerns when Congress seeks information from someone who is not the president versus when Congress seeks information from someone who is the president. And the extension of that doctrine serves the larger purpose that we keep trying to flag here on Opening Arguments of diminishing the powers of government. And again, remember that that nihilism is the objective of the Federalist Society, right? Is the objective of the intellectual heavyweights on the conservative right right now. They want no branch of government to be able to do anything.
Yeah. I mean, unless it's Donald Trump who could, like, you know, fire the entire federal bureaucracy with a stroke of a pen. But yes, in general. And right. My point is that here you have Mazars in the complaint filed by D.A. Bragg. And, you know, it's another kind of creeping acceptance of Mazars as the standard to assess all congressional subpoenas. And I don't know whether it's appropriate, you know, whether or not I think it's appropriate is kind of beside the point. Here it is. And to be honest, I don't have a lot of problem with it here. Okay, yes, like D.A. Bragg's office is not the president, but it is part of an executive branch, right? So you're not talking about separation of powers versus, you know, with Congress, the legislative branch and the executive branch occupied by the president of the United States. But you are, in some sense, talking about separate sovereign entities. So I don't think it's a terrible way to use this four-factor test. I just would like to flag that it drives me crazy because that's not what this decision was about at all.
Yeah, I agree with you on both parts of that. So, okay, back to this discussion. See, look, we each got a deep dive. I like that.
Cool.
So, assume that Mazars is the operative standard, which I think is clearly how a court is going to decide here. Even if that's the case, the Pomerantz subpoena very clearly fails all four prongs of the Mazars test, right? So first was comparing the asserted legislative purpose against the harm of the intrusion. Cannot, right? Again, as Bragg points out, that you have to resolve that against the subpoena because Congress has no power under Article 1 of the Constitution to oversee, right? Like, let alone interfere with ongoing state criminal matters.
And even if you accepted this, you know, bullshit explanation that Congress has to legislate the protocol between of the Secret Service's interaction with, like, the state law enforcement, state cops, you would not need to know the inner workings of the district attorney's office in this specific case to get, you know, to make that law. This is just way, way, way over that.
Yeah. So, okay. First prong is out. The second prong is whether the subpoena is no broader than reasonably necessary to support Congress's legislative objective. And here, couple bad facts, right? Jordan hasn't provided any evidence that Congress needs the information he's seeking at all. The subpoena is written quite broadly. And, you know, as you just heard on the clip that we played about 10 minutes ago, Jim Jordan's buddies go on Fox News all the time talking about how this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Right. And additionally, Bragg notes that the congressional letter threatens to drop a whole bunch more subpoenas, as did Comer in that clip. But let's quote from the Bragg complaint. In fact, Republican Representative Wesley Hunt, a member of the Judiciary, confirmed that more subpoenas are coming in an interview on Fox News on April 6, 2023. During that interview, Mr. Hunt stated, "I can assure you that Jim Jordan, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee, has a plan for all of these people to expose them for exactly who they are." He said, "They have an agenda to destroy our country. They have an agenda to destroy the very fabric of America. We've got to expose this so that in 2 years, gosh, what happens in 2 years? Would that be an election? The American people, we the people, can get this right." It's not subtle.
No. And look, from a legal perspective, it's kind of hard to argue you've issued a narrowly tailored subpoena when, you know, your buddies are giving the game away on Fox every time they open their damn mouths. Mm-hmm. So third factor, we go kind of quickly through these, is the nature of the evidence offered by Congress to establish that the subpoena advances a valid legislative purpose. We've discussed that that's none. And then the fourth factor is the burdens imposed by the subpoena. And, you know, pretty obvious that that would interfere with an ongoing criminal investigation and prosecution. So bottom line, even if they get the Mazar standard, Jordan can't possibly meet any of its four prongs.
Right. And more importantly, even if Jordan could somehow demonstrate a valid legislative purpose and satisfy the Mazar standard to, like, interfere with this one case, the subpoena would still not be enforceable because it would allow the committee to seek secret grand jury material, confidential investigative material, and information clearly protected by the attorney-client and various other legal privileges. And as Bragg's complaint notes, the whole point of those privileges in the first place is to prevent the disclosure of confidential law enforcement and legal materials compiled during investigations and in the lead up to a prosecution.
Yeah. So that's the law. Pretty clear. I think we would also be remiss if we didn't point out that Bragg takes head on Jim Jordan's anti-Semitic dog whistling. These are the talking points that are circulating right now on InfoWars, on Breitbart, in the right-wingosphere, that, you know, this is all a Jewish plot.
Yeah, and, you know, as a member of the J team, I do appreciate you bringing this up. So here's how he put it. Meanwhile, on March 19th, 2023, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy amplified Mr. Trump's incendiary rhetoric, accusing D.A. Bragg of, quote, abusing his office to target President Trump, and announced that Congress would, quote, investigate any use of federal funds that are used to facilitate the perversion of justice by Soros-backed DAs across the country. George Soros is a Jewish-American businessman and a philanthropist known for his support of liberal causes and candidates. He did not add, but I will. And he's a Holocaust survivor who is constantly smeared as being, you know, anti-Semitic. It's gross. Bragg goes on. Soros is frequently cited as a boogeyman in right-wing and often anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and dog whistles. District Attorney Bragg does not know Mr. Soros and has never communicated with him.
So good on Alvin Bragg for calling that out in press. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, we need to be doing that in court proceedings more often. And we will wrap up the story after we thank our new patrons. So thank you to It's a Low Bar to Limbo Under, to Shep, Ash, Cameron Kushwara, Carolyn Casey.
And thank you to Cynthia Fell, Terry Oliver, TT, Veronica Sixsmith, Ryan Martinez, and Tom.
And if you'd like to be thanked here and you'd like to get a shout out, you know how to do that. Just head on over to patreon.com/law, sign up for as little as a buck every other episode, and you'll get the extended bonus. So you'll get all the goodies. You can see that over at patreon.com, and you will get our sincere thanks for helping make this show possible.
Thanks, guys.
So we've broken down the legal arguments. They seem pretty strong. Is there anything we should be, you know, panicking about? Maybe something we tweeted out?
Okay. So Bragg's complaint was docketed yesterday afternoon, and it was assigned to Judge Mary Viscosal. Please go ahead and get your pronunciation videos ready. I'm sure I'm going to butcher it. So Judge Viscosal is a Trump appointee. But as you know, there are Trump judges and there are Trump judges. Right. And Judge Viscosal was originally put on the federal bench by Barack Obama, who named her to the bankruptcy court. She's basically fine. Brass tacks, like, New York ain't Florida. And, you know, despite me constantly wanting to call her Judge Vicodin, she's not Judge Aileen Cannon.
We need to get like a bumper from House on Vicodin.
You know, there are other ways to manage pain.
Like what? Laughter, meditation. Got a guy that can fix my third chakra.
Anyway, what comes to mind is my friend from law school, Judge Gallagher, who was initially named as a potential judge in the United States District Court for the District of Maryland by Barack Obama, was put on infinite hiatus because of Mitch McConnell, and then was ultimately named to the bench by Donald Trump. I would be perfectly happy to have a case in front of Judge Gallagher.
So. I mean, counterpoint, Rod Rosenstein.
All right. Well, we can't resolve that one now. But,
I know. Okay.
Slings and arrows.
Sorry about that. So incidentally, Bragg's office is represented here by Ted Boutros, the global head of litigation at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. He is an absolute litigation legend. And he once wrote an article in Politico entitled "Why I'll Defend Anyone Trump Sues for Speaking Freely." That was during the Trump campaign. And he actually did it. He represented reporters Brian Karam and Jim Acosta, both of whom lost their White House press passes when they pissed off Trump. Anyway, Boutros, on Bragg's behalf, filed for emergency relief. That is, he asked for a temporary restraining order and he asked for a preliminary injunction.
Yeah. And let's break that down really quickly, that the same injunctive relief standards apply. But the point of a temporary restraining order is to preserve the status quo, right? It's saying, look, something's going to happen that is about to radically change things. And we need the court to jump in and say, stop, put a halt to it until we sort everything out.
Right. And in this case, the defendants hadn't even been served. So it's a pretty radical remedy if you want that.
That's right. And add on top of it that the harm, right, is Pomerantz showing up for his deposition and, you know, Pomerantz already said he wasn't going to show up for his deposition. So, yeah, it was not a surprise to me that the TRO was denied. I do not read that as some, I think, less deep and less responsible sources here on the left have of, you know, Trump judge denying relief, you know, against Jim Jordan. That's not how I read it. And, you know, if I'm wrong, I'll, you know, we'll do what Andrew was wrong. But I think that, you know, but I think that we're in a situation where I would not read into the likelihood of granting the preliminary injunction, right? That is telling Congress whether or not it can continue to request that Pomerantz show up on the basis of the denial of that TRO.
Right. I mean, and so to be clear, Judge Viscoso scheduled a hearing on that injunction for the 19th. I think that's Wednesday. Pomerantz has already said he wasn't going to show up for that subpoena on the 20th. So, I mean, nothing really is going to change before then. So I'm not particularly surprised. I don't know. It's what do you think is about to happen here?
I think that's an illustration that while there is urgency, right, there's not, hey, file this brief by midnight levels of urgency, right? Like Judge Viscoso isn't going to sit on this, but, right, there was no inherent need, I think, to issue a TRO to preserve the status quo, as the status quo is nobody's getting anything until this court decides. So, and probably not even then.
I don't. I mean, as we've said, the judiciary is really loath to step in and undo a congressional subpoena. Although, you know, congressional subpoenas have not in the past been so batshit crazy and you know, contrary to law and precedent. So I don't know. And as I said before, like we didn't really have the Mazar standard, but now we have the Mazar standard and we've all kind of agreed. I mean, I don't agree, but everybody else appears to have agreed that that's how you evaluate, you know, a congressional subpoena. So, you know, maybe that is going to be the court's new job.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we will find out, obviously, next week. We will be following this with much interest. And in the Patreon bonus, we are going to tell you about a very significant ruling at the D.C. Circuit concerning one of the main charges against hundreds of January 6th insurrectionists. So you won't want to miss that. But if you're just here for the free version of the show, thank you so much for listening. We love having you. We love doing it for you. And we will see you tomorrow.
See you guys.
You got into Harvard Law?
What, like it's hard?
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Liz. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Spotify, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @OpenArgs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, with assistance from Teresa Gomez and Deborah Smith.
Opening Arguments is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, copyright 2023, all rights reserved.